Mini episode 513 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 513. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris. Proud to welcome back on a great guest that we had on the show in the past. He was actually on with us during the tail end of our incarnation when we were doing a full-length broadcast back at the old Sports Talk Network. Remember those guys? Well, this was back in 2010, and back when that place was there and we were at that place, we had this gentleman on the show, and it's a pleasure to be able to welcome him back on the occasion of his book being published, Through the Eye of the Tiger, The Rock and Roll Life of Survivor's Founding Member, a great rock and roll veteran from over the period of time here, somebody who, again, founding member of Survivor, Ides of March, somebody who has co-written songs for the likes of a lot of the greats out there, 38 Special, Leonard Skinner, Cheap Trick, Sammy Hagar, the REO Speedwagon, the Beach Boys, a couple of my favorites in there. Certainly, and right now he is fronting Pride of Lions, a melodic rock band, also getting into smooth jazz with the Life Force out there performing, playing regularly, promoting the book. It's a pleasure to have back on the show one of our great guests over a period of time, Jim Peterick. We're coming back on the program today. Jim, welcome back to the FDH Lounge. Sir, pleasure to have you on. How are you today?
I'm great, Rick. Thanks for having me on. I love your show. And boy, I can't believe it was 2010. It seems like yesterday we talked. How time flies. It's crazy.
Hard to believe. But yeah, I'm so glad to have you back on. And again, I really enjoyed having you on previously. When I heard that you were on the horizon to be back on, I was very happy to hear that. I was very grateful to receive the book from your publisher. It's an excellent book with a foreword from Kevin Cronin of REO Speedwagon, your life story, a very compelling one, going through the years. And it's unfortunate at this moment when we're talking about this, it's an air of sort of bittersweet, I suppose, hanging over when we talk about the survivor period of your career, the very prominent one, the passing a few months back of your good friend and fellow bandmate Jimmy Jameson. We'd had him on the program a couple times. I had just gotten to meet him in person about 2 weeks before, unfortunately, he collapsed. So I'm sure over the period of time, the last couple of months, I'm sure you've been involved in making tribute statements and the like, and reflecting publicly on your time with him. So just like to get your thoughts on that and what Jimmy meant to you personally and professionally.
Yeah, sure. It was just a huge tragedy, a huge loss. And, you know, when certain people pass away, you have some kind of warning. Nobody saw coming. At least I sure didn't. When I got the news, I just thought it was impossible. You know, it didn't sink in that this wonderful, vital person that still had so much to give to the music world, it was gone. And you know, I kept rewinding it in my head, and I couldn't wrap my head around it. I'm still, you know, still grappling with it. But my way of grieving, Rick, is maybe the best way I can do it, and that's really to write music in memory of it. And a few weeks after Jimmy passed, I just started writing a song, and it was called Heaven Passes the Torch. And it was not only about Jimmy, but it was also in memory of Fergie Frederickson, who died the same year, ironically, two of the greatest melodic rock singers, you know, we've known. And all of a sudden, you know, that's my way of grieving. And it started taking shape, and the song took shape. And I put it together, and at the church service, not the original church service in the family, but a few weeks later in Memphis, there was a very large church service at a very large church. And I got to, they cut a video, they meaning the people that were putting on the event, put on, created a video to Heaven Passes the Torch with images of Jimmy through the years. And it was on the big screen, and the whole church just was like in tears. And that was the first real thing I did, you know, in Jimmy's memory. A few weeks later, it was in Memphis again, of course, Jimmy's hometown, at the Hard Rock Cafe. And this time it was an outpouring of so many in the rock community. You know, we had, you know, Night Ranger and David Pack and Lynyrd Skynyrd and yours truly. And I can't even begin to name all the groups. And, of course, some of the groups that Jimmy cut his teeth with, members of Target, members of Cobra. And even before that, you know, the debuts when Jimmy was nothing more than 17 years old, all paying their tribute, you know. And that was the day that I was able to reconnect for the first time with Mark Jubé, the original drummer of Survivor. Well, actually the second drummer, but the one that we had the majority of success with. And he came bursting into the green room, and I couldn't believe it. I was like seeing someone I hadn't seen since 1986. And we hugged, and he said, "I just read your book, and I loved it." And it was just a great moment, but it was almost as if Jimmy brought us together again.
Yeah, that's the way these things happen a lot of times. You know, fortunately or unfortunately, I guess fortunately in the sense of people getting brought back together, but certainly funerals, memorial services, and the like tend to do that. That sounds like a great way of honoring him and paying tribute with what you've been doing creatively. And there are, of course, a number of different ways that these type of things take form. Not long after Jimmy passed away, we had his good friend Bobby Kimball back on the show, and we're talking with him. He specifically mentioned he is hoping to put together a tribute band in 2015 and actually specifically buttonholed me for if I had any ideas where they could come in Northeast Ohio, kind of put me on the spot, which I didn't mind at all. I very... very honored and pleased if I can come up with any ideas for them, and I've been working on that. But that makes me think to ask you, has there been any communication along those lines? Of course, I know that everybody involved has got their own very busy schedules, but has there been any thought of possibly hitting any dates with that tribute band once they get out?
Well, if that's a reality, of course. Right now we're doing it piecemeal. You know, I do the thing called World Stage a few times every year, and Bobby Kimball's coming out this Saturday to perform with me at the Wentz Center in North Central College, as well as Rick Emmett of Triumph and Mike Greeno, Loverboy, The Ides of March, you know, Pride of Lions. And with the Pride of Lions set, we're honoring Jimmy with Man Against the World, which we haven't performed at all since back in the day. And Toby, of course, really delivers it. Every time I do a show with the Ides of March, I now dedicate The Search Is Over to Jimmy and tell the story behind it about the first time that he auditioned for the band, and Frankie and I showed him that song, and he just nailed it. I still get goosebumps when I think about him singing it for the first time. So even though it's not a formal tribute band, we're paying tribute to him every show I do.
That's a very nice way of approaching it. As you said, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. Yeah, you can always insert those in terms of your regular performances. Please say hi to Bobby for the show when you see him again. We've greatly enjoyed having him on previously. I have fond memories of him being on, and a funny memory of the first time that he came on. A couple days beforehand, he emailed me just to set up the logistics. I just happened to be listening at the time because I love mashups. A mashup of a Jay-Z song playing over Africa. And I emailed it to him back, and I said, "Have you ever heard this before?" And he emailed back and said, "No, but it sounds like somebody owes us some royalties." So,
yeah.
I didn't have the heart to explain to him the way that YouTube works and that you know, it's the wild, wild west. But what a great guy himself. What a great community, really, of all of you guys in that scene from the 70s and 80s out there, that melodic rock community. A lot of great folks out there like you and Bobby.
You know, mentioning the melodic rock community, another one of these synchronicity moments, of course, Andrew McNeese, you know who he is, melodicrock.com. He did the Melodic Rock Fest, and I could not play Friday or Saturday. This is a few months ago, because I had shows. But Sunday I was available, and he created kind of an unplugged day at the hotel, which turned out to be a great thing. The book, my book, had just come out, and I was able to sell them at the event. But various bands from Friday and Saturday showed up and played unplugged. And, you know, Gary Moon, you know, was there and did amazing. But the group right before I went on, or perhaps right after, I can't recall, was a group I hadn't heard of before called Work of Art. It's a band from Sweden, I believe. I believe it's Sweden, that Frontiers had signed. And it's Robert, a guy named Robert Saul, S-A-L-L, on guitar, and lead singer Lars Safsund, and then and other musicians too. But those two are like the chief songwriters and singers. Lars is the singer. And at the same time, I was writing another song for Jimmy and Fergie called The Music Remembers. And it's a beautiful, moody song. And all of a sudden, in my head, I heard Lars singing this song, and I called them up. Well, I emailed them. You know, I got the number from Andrew. It turns out, you know, they're big fans of mine and Survivor, and long distance from America to Sweden, they ended up doing the song with me. And that is also, I can mention now, because it's official, there's an album coming out in April, Torch. The Music Remembers Jimmy Jameson and Fergie Frederiksen. And it's pretty amazing. Frontiers is putting it out, a very limited edition of 500 physical copies. I think the demand is going to be so great, they're going to put out a lot more. But we're going to premiere it at the Milan Rock Fest that I'm doing with Pride of Lions and a new singer that I'm working with on Frontiers named Mark Shearer, who is one of these amazing, you know, five-octave voices that I love to work with. And we're performing at the Melodic, at the Frontiers Rock Fest in Milan, April 11th and 12th. We're headlining on the 12th. And that disc will be premiering and be for sale for the first time on the grounds. What it is a compilation of a lot of the greatest tracks that Jimmy and Fergie recorded in the Frontiers years. You know, and there's, of course, it includes a lot of the songs that I wrote for Fergie and with Fergie, and the entire album that I wrote and produced for Jimmy called Crossroads Moment, which came out in 2009 or 10, M10, kind of crossed those 2 years. In addition, there'll be five new tracks, including Heaven Passes the Torch with Bobby Kimball and many others. The Music Remembers, with David Peck of Ambrosia. It includes another new track with, Mike Reno, and then Kelly Kagi's on another track. So it's five new tracks, and then the best of the Frontiers years of both artists. We're very excited about that.
That's incredible. That's a lot going on right there, and to have it debuting at that festival is going to be an amazing experience for people there, no question about it. And when we're talking about the melodic rock community, there's an obvious tie-in in terms of your book mentioned previously here. The foreword was written by Kevin Cronin of REO Speedwagon, who is able to speak first and foremost as a friend of yours, and also to get kind of insight about your career as well. What I found to be interesting was, from what he was saying, was reinforced, obviously, as I was reading the book, and that being, because you said in very early in the book, too, that it's not your typical rock and roll story, but as he pointed out, that the darkness that really kind of looms over so many people with their personal lives in rock, even if professionally it's not always the case, but personally, that's not evident in your case. And I have to say, you know, in terms of people who've been on the program here, rock stars, the over-under for number of marriages that they've had is probably 2.5. So, you know, your story is definitely atypical in that regard, and kind of interesting, and I would say probably encouraging for anybody getting into the biz that, you know, you don't have to live that kind of a turbulent life to make it in the business.
Right. And Rick, that was one of the reasons I waited to write my book. I really didn't know if it would be interesting to hear of a person's life that didn't have the ups and, you know, major ups and downs. You know, I read these autobiographies like junk food. I buy them all. And, you know, when you read four members of Duran Duran and they all have the same story of, you know, rehab and groupies and, you know, just near-death experiences and Motley Crue's and, you know, I go, is my life really going to be interesting? But as I wrote it, I realized that maybe what makes it interesting is the fact that I have been married for 42 years and juggled a career of touring with a family life and somehow made it work. And really, you know, the thread of the tension within the band Survivor, especially between me and the lead guitarist Frankie Sullivan, really caused a lot of drama in my life. And I was able to deal with it mainly because I poured myself back into the music and, you know, as I say in the book, kind of created a creative bubble around myself so I could deal with that tension.
Well, and that's very interesting. And you and I had briefly discussed Frankie off air to segue. I'll get to that now and just ask you to comment in general, because there is, and again, a reputation for, you know, volatility, I suppose would be one way of putting it, but it's out there. And as I mentioned to you off here, I got to experience a certain portion of that when I did an interview with a couple of the guys from Survivor this past summer. And it was a little uncomfortable for me to do. I'll just kind of put it that way because of the general vibe of things. So, again, for somebody who coexisted over a long period of time, had some great professional successes, I'm sure some personal times in between all of that that you might look upon fondly. How do you basically sum up the experience of dealing with Frankie Sullivan over a long period of time?
Well, it was a challenge, to say the least. I knew that in many ways the ends justified the means, because I knew that he was a killer guitar player and a very appealing stage presence. And, you know, when we got together to write, he put on his best face and his, you know, put best foot forward. And even though he wasn't an extremely strong songwriter on his own, he was able to kind of herd me in the right directions. If I was going the wrong way in one sense or another, usually his sarcasm and kind of, you know, manner would bring me back on board. That's the good side of Frankie. The bad side for me was we were very, very different in the way we treated people on the road and just in our general lives. I have a real strong ethic about the fans and how I like to treat the fans and friends for that matter. I share a lot of that with Jimmy Jameson, who he and I were really on the same page. You know, when we would do a radio interview together, Frankie would be listening and actually be jealous at our camaraderie and how well the disc jockeys, you know, got along with us and loved us. We were the ones to stay at the end of every show, you know, signing the autographs. And just like Jimmy, I would give anything to the fans, you know, because the fans are what made us. Without them, you can't stay home and play your guitar, you know. And it was just I saw a certain attitude in Frankie that I could never quite cotton to and never quite could understand. So, you know, that was really the biggest dichotomy, I think. And the other thing, of course, which is my eternal cross to bear, is that I didn't stand up for myself greater to be a co-lead singer on some songs, which was the original design of Survivor, to kind of have a format like, you know, Jack Bruce and Eric Clapton, where they would both be, we'd both be vocalists, being Dave. And it's not to take anything away from Dave or Jimmy, because they're amazing, amazing singers, as you know. But when John Klodner signed us, he thought we were a two-singer band. And just through his manner, it was discouraged by Frankie. And I'm not the kind of guy that likes conflict. And instead of saying, you know what, I'm singing, screw you, I took a back seat and played keyboards and was the good soldier. But, you know, with the Ides of March, I was nothing but the front man. I was nothing but the lead singer. So when I reformed Survivor in the 90s, I felt like I was back home again in the spotlight, talking to the crowd, singing lead, playing lead guitar, all those things that had fallen away, you know, with Survivor.
Well, it's very interesting there, and you talking about Frankie, you said something that I think is going to be universally relatable to anybody that's in music. Or I always point out that music, I think, has a lot in common with entrepreneurialism, brand building, folks like myself trying to build a brand. It's always a matter of hustling and trying to make it sometimes on a shoestring. What you said about the ends justifying the means, I think we've all been there to a degree. Any of us that have really dabbled in either of these parallel worlds, you get involved in a situation with somebody and it generally ends the way that your situation with Frankie ended. But for a period of time, it really is easy to justify. You know, things seem to be going well. You're getting some things that are progressing. And you think to yourself, well, maybe it all worked out in the end. But like I said, I think what you described is very relatable. And it's just amazing that, you know, almost 100% of the time the story seems to end the same way when that's what the dynamic is.
Right. You know, at a point when it's when the success isn't there and the ends no longer justify the means, it becomes more apparent that I can't live like this anymore. You know, and that was in 1996 when I actually, you know, did not get on a plane that was going to a show. And I tell the story in the book. I won't give it away, but I call it the day that Frankie drew the line and I never crossed it again. But it's one relatable thing to the present is, I just finished producing an album for a singer named Mark Shearer. I don't sing on this album because I chose not to. I co-sing in the band Pride of Lions, so I wanted to keep that special to that brand. But there's a song on their album that is really speaking from my heart, and it's called Independence Day, and it outlines the very day I did not get on that plane, and, you know, and I did not go to the gig that Survivor was playing with 38 Special down south. And my wife couldn't believe it. She couldn't believe I finally made a statement and stood up to Frankie and said, I'm not taking it anymore. And happened to be, guess what, the 4th of July, Independence Day. And my wife and I and tiny Colin, who was very young at the time, toddled over to the fireworks in my hometown here, Burr Ridge. And I didn't know what I was feeling. It was surreal. I was watching the fireworks. I was seeing the celebration at the time. But at the same time, I was feeling, what the hell did I do? You know, was it the right move? It was filled with doubt and yet somehow elated at the same time that I finally took a stand. And it's all in that song.
Absolutely. And I understand that. And it's a very... It's a weird feeling, but like you said, really kind of in a way triumphant when it does come, because again, a lot of times these circumstances just kind of play themselves out. The usefulness comes to an end. You know, the good no longer outweighs the band, whatever bad, whatever description or cliche you want to put on it. Absolutely, that's what it usually comes to. You've alluded to you know, some of the songwriting that you've done over the years, songwriting for some great bands, obviously songwriting for your own band. The story out of all of them in the book that I found to be the most interesting involved your first prominent band, Ides of March, specifically the story of Vehicle. I would guess that prior to you writing the book, nobody out there would have really gleaned what that was about. But the woman who would go on to become your wife, who at the time really wasn't involved with you at all, but, you know, you're ferrying her around and at the time and feeling some, I don't know if resentment would be too strong a word, but whatever it was that kind of caused you to go there in that moment and start to get the seeds of the idea, to me, that was the most interesting song. Backstory that you described in the entire book, and there were some great stories.
Well, thank you. You know, you can't make that stuff up. It was real life, and of course, that song has survived, no pun intended, for, you know, almost 50 years, and you still. I heard it on CBS Morning News 3 days ago. It was a story about a car, or a lady that tore up a car wash in their plane vehicle. I go, oh my God, Karen and I are laying out in bed watching TV. We're going, that song is still around, and I'm still lying next to the same lady that inspired it.
That is an unbelievable story. Yeah, if you would have guessed the way that everything was going to play out once you wrote that one, but it's really a fascinating one. And again, so many of the songs that we love have backstories out there that are really interesting like that. And in terms of the sound of that band, and obviously that was by far the biggest single of it, but for anybody that's really listened to Ides of March, again, a band, it seems, of its time. You listen to the music and you're thinking late 60s, early 70s sound. Survivor, as we know, the quintessential 80s sound. That makes you one of the, I can think of probably few people else who have really bridged different eras like that with different bands. Is that one of the things, upon reflecting on your career, that's really something that you've reflected upon over the years, is being a part of two distinct sounds at the time as they were happening with different bands?
Absolutely. And actually, you're slighting the 60s, because I don't mean maliciously. But when the Ides of March started in 64, we were a Beatles, a British Invasion band. Our first song was You Wouldn't Listen. It was a hit on Parrot Records in 66. Not a giant hit. It was number 7 in Chicago. It was number 42 on Billboard. But it took us around the country. I was only 15 years old. And all of a sudden, we're on stage with some great bands, like the Allman Brothers before they were the Allman Brothers. They were called the Allman Joys. And we're playing with them in Daytona Beach, Florida. And we're playing with all these bands that went on to become huge bands. And I'm 15, and we're doing this kind of, Hollies meets the Kinks meets the Beatles thing. So from there, we graduated to the horn thing. And then we became a 70s band, kind of on the same page as Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Chicago, Lighthouse, whatever, and Vehicle reflected that. The 80s came along, and, I reinvented myself to be, I think maybe Frankie and I, our prototype early on was somewhere between Boston and Foreigner. Those were the bands that we loved, and some of the very early stuff, you could hear that influence. But I think the key is, and then of course today, I'm all over the deck from country rock to every kind of music, Beach Boys and Brian Wilson. But I think the whole thing is being adaptable as a songwriter to styles, and also adaptable as an arranger in the studio. My feeling is, to some extent, and with some exceptions, if you take a great song and you can arrange it 16 different ways, and it's still a great song. And that's kind of true. You take Searches Over, and you could arrange it like a Katy Perry bit track and put some inner beats in it like they do now. They take a ballad. They can make a dance song out of any kind of ballad you want. It's all in the arrangement.
Absolutely. That's very much along the lines of the theme for that Las Vegas show a couple of years ago. He took that Elvis tune and put some real modern beat behind it. So, yeah, absolutely. And you can find a ton of that stuff out there on YouTube, just like the aforementioned mashups. And it's amazing to get to hear things like that presented in a new way. And, of course, beyond the performing over the years, starting some of these bands, being part of the backbone of them, as alluded to a minute ago here, you did a lot of songwriting over the years. There's a gentleman that I've gotten to know recently. It would be presumptuous if I'd say he was a friend of mine, but I think of him kind of as a friend. One of your contemporaries, Joe Vitale, who I know he has gotten a lot of satisfaction out of some of the songwriting he's done for the likes of Joe Walsh and some of the other guys out there. How much satisfaction are you able to get when you're putting it down there? It's being performed by somebody else. The world will tend to associate that band with the song, but to know that you're responsible for it, either partially or completely, as far as the formation out of it, how does that make you feel inside?
You know, it's a thrill. I won't say it's as big of a thrill sometimes as having performed it yourself, but if it's done well, like 38 Special, for instance, or Sammy Hagar, I couldn't have done it better. I couldn't have done it, you know, and when I hear Dan Barnes delivering, you know, Hold On Loosely, I'm going, I'm as thrilled about that as if I was singing it myself. You know, there was a funny story in the book, though, of course, about their first hit, Rockin' Into the Night, because that was supposed to be a Survivor track. And of course, it became a top 10 for 38 Special because our A&R person, John Kaladner, handed it over secretly to Mark Spector, 38 Special's manager, and they cut it and put it out. And that was really the seeds of, you know, some of the bad feelings in the early part of the band. But, you know, getting back on track, I really think, you know, writing a song for another artist can be extremely rewarding and kind of pouring yourself into that artist's perception. I'm a big believer in collaboration when a collaboration is right. Collaborations don't always work. The chemistry may not work. You know, you may be in the room with an extremely talented songwriter, and yet you just don't click. And it's happened to me. I can't mention names, but it's happened to me at least three times where I was in the room with major, major talent, but somehow we canceled each other out.
Yeah, these things happen. I suppose in a lot of different creative arts, chemistry is very important, and sometimes you either have it or you don't have it as far as producing something. And that's a great story, by the way, about 38 Special, another one of my favorite groups, and to think of the alternate history of Survivor performing that instead of 38 Special. That's an interesting thing to contemplate. But even without that big hit, obviously Survivor had that amazing heyday, such that Eye of the Tiger is even invoked as the title of this book, Through the Eye of the Tiger, the Rock and Roll Life of Survivor's founding member. To be a part of one of the very biggest bands in the world there in the 80s, you know, back in my school days there, and hearing it on the radio all the time. And again, what was it like to be part of a band at that moment?
Well, you know, it was great, Rick, but in like I say in the book, in some ways it was bittersweet. I couldn't enjoy it quite as much as I would have liked to. I remember Eye of the Tiger. I don't have this in the book, but it's a true story. The band, maybe I do. The record label had a big party for us in New Orleans before a show on a day off when Eye of the Tiger reached number one. And the president of Epic Records stood up and said, "We owe it all to Jim Peterik." And at that point, Frankie was elbows and a-holes out the door, okay? And I don't blame him. You know, I mean, look, Frankie, whatever he is and what he is, and he was a big part of the creation of the Eye of the Tiger and the Eye of the Tiger album. So there was some uncomfortable moments because I'm very good with people. People perceive me in a certain way, and they reward me for it. But sometimes it's not always fair.
Well, you know, you're probably right. That probably wasn't fair to him, but I will just say selfishly, based on my experience of interviewing Frankie Sullivan, I cherish that story, and I suppose there's probably a lot of other people that would cherish that story. I'm not going to lie. I'm not necessarily I'm not a saint. We all have things that we cherish that we probably shouldn't, but that's a great story, and I can just imagine how that would have been reacted to.
Well, you know, to some extent, the president of the company was correct. I was the guy that created Survivor. It was the name that I came up with. I financed out of my own pocket all the demo tapes that ultimately created ultimately got us signed, pardon me. And Kaladner was a fan of Jim Peterik before he signed the band because he knew me from Ides of March. I remember trying to get a solo deal in 1976 and playing my wares for Jerry Greenberg over at Atlantic, and Kaladner was the go-to boy. He was the guy that was fetching tapes for Jerry Greenberg. But he had big ears, and he was listening to everything Jim Peterik was playing that day, and he never forgot it. So, you know, in a way, you know, I shouldn't feel too bad about the accolades.
Sure, absolutely. You did a lot to earn them. But as you said, that is a pretty funny story as far as how those words came out of the mouth and how they were received. But it's interesting in looking at your career, and I think this is a coincidence, because if I remember correctly, I think the last musical guest that we had on the show some weeks back was Steve Smith. There's not a lot of guys I can think of out there that really bridge rock and jazz, and I think you two might be the only ones that we've ever had on who really do that. I'm really intrigued by the direction that you're taking now, having this smooth jazz group, Jim Peterick's Life Force, as you said, still doing some stuff with Pride of Lions, which is still in the melodic genre. So talk about that, about how you enjoy dabbling in the different areas in music, and obviously that must be a great way for you to continue to grow in music even after all this time.
Well, it really is. You know, when we used to get off the road, you know, after, you know, being on the road for months at a time, I would come home, and there was that period of decompression and transition when you're trying to become a family man again and not just a road dog, you know. And the last thing I wanted to do was listen to hard rock at home. And this was in the 80s, and Karen and I discovered all these great smooth jazz. They didn't call it smooth jazz at the time. They just called it, I don't know what they called it, to be honest. But there were groups like, you know, Spyro Gyra, Fatburger, the Yellow Jackets, and my favorite of all, Acoustic Alchemy. Pat Metheny, this is what we listened to at home when we wanted to chill out. And it was such a great escape, you know, from the rock world. And it wasn't too many years ago, and Karen was listening to me at the piano saying, why don't you get into smooth jazz? Why don't you do an album like that? And I go, really? You know, and so it was. And I really enjoyed making the, so far there's been two Life Force albums and a few smooth jazz albums that I did with a girl named Lisa McLowry. And one of them I'm very proud of in particular, because it's Lisa McLowry sings the songs of Acoustic Alchemy. Well, as you know, Acoustic Alchemy is an instrumental group. But I've always loved their melodies and always dreamed of putting words and you know, melodies over their chord changes and using some of their melodies. So Lisa opened up for Acoustic Alchemy in Milwaukee, and I was part of her band, and, you know, I did a few songs with her. And then met the band, and they're from England, and I said, boy, it'd be great if, and I told them my dream, and the lead guitar player says, have a go at it. Have a go at it, Mike, you know, and the rest is history. I turned like 12 of their greatest instrumentals into really viable smooth jazz vocal songs, and it's called Lisa McLowry Sings Acoustic Alchemy. So, you know, it's available on my website, and it's just absolutely terrific.
That is awesome. The chance to get to do something like that and to allow somebody to be presented in a new way, that's incredible. Of course, jimpeterick.com, as you mentioned, is, of course, the hub where people can get that. Yeah, you mentioned Spyro Gyra. I had a friend back in the day who got me into some of the same stuff. Definitely listened to some Spyro Gyra, some stuff further out on the jazz spectrum like Maynard Ferguson, Chuck Mangione, et cetera. But you're right. There's a lot of stuff out there that is really tremendous along those lines. And it's, again, to your credit, for you to be dabbling in that and participating and expanding yourself in that way. Of course, you had mentioned to me also upcoming, you've mentioned off air, this Last Man Standing set, 5-disc set for Ides of March, because, again, about 50 years for that band being around since the formation. So, talk about that, anything else that you've got going on presently, in addition, of course, to the book. Obviously, you're out there still touring and playing with a lot of different projects.
Well, yeah, I'm doing book signings at various you know, bookstores, the ever-shrinking bookstore, but they're still out there. And Barnes & Noble is still in business for the moment. And those turn into like mini concerts, you know, and it's not just people passing me signing a book. I bring my guitar, I tell stories, I sing songs, you know, I might do 5 or 6, 7 songs, depending on, and then I take a Q&A. But the Ides set is very exciting. It's a box set that were putting out. Baker & Taylor is distributing them. It was a great distributor, so we're very fortunate with that. But the first four discs are music CDs, and we licensed the best of the Warner Brothers two albums, the best of the RCA albums. In fact, the RCA stuff, which is now owned by Sony, it's the first time they've ever been dubbed to digital, so they had to take the master tapes and bake them in an oven so that the oxide doesn't turn into mud. And this is the very first time it'll be available. It's pretty cool. And then we wrote three brand new songs. One's the title cut, Last Band Standing, which I wrote with Mike Borch, the drummer of the band. And it tells the history of the band kind of in a song from the beginning to up to now. And we have Steve Cropper from the Blues Brothers and the famous, Booker T and the MGs guitarist. He's guesting on the track, which is huge thrill. I'm a huge Steve Cropper fan. He wrote like Midnight Hour and Soul Man and Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding. Ridiculous guy, just amazing. And then another new song called Who I Am, which is like amazing high energy horn rock. And then Too Far to Turn Around, which I wrote in China last summer when I was there in near Beijing, playing for 80,000 people that all were all chanting the words phonetically to Eye of the Tiger. And then the fifth disc is a DVD, and it's recorded live at the House of Blues in May 31st of last year. It was a terrific night, great crowd. We were on our games, 11-camera shoot, and we have 14 tracks that we're presenting from that concert with interviews of the Ides, and then some archival videos from the old days, the Dick Clark's Mama Cash show that he produced and the John Biner show, and yeah, very, very corny, sets and fake drums, and we're lip syncing and we're in these ridiculous clothes from the 60s or early 70s, bell bottoms. But people love, I love that. I love to see where a band started. So that's coming out in April.
That's awesome. That people can really get immersed in the full experience of the band. It sounds like a real completist way to kind of take a tour through the career. And again, an excellent career with that band and all around Survivor and everything in between with the songwriting, the other bands or the projects that you've been associated with since. And now adding author to that, the book Through the Eye of the Tiger, The Rock and Roll Life of Survivor's Founding Member. Jim Peterick, a pleasure to have you back on the show, sir. And we'll make sure that it's not such a gap between appearances as it was last time to this time, because I enjoyed it way too much. We'll make it happen again much, much sooner and catch up with you as things continue to progress for you.
Yeah, and I want to do a special shout-out to my buddy, our buddy, Steve Cervello, who is just a big champion of the things I do, and he was at the book signing in New York City, and just I appreciate, all that he does and hooking us up again, and I'm just really, really pleased to be on the show, Rick.
He's a very big fan of yours, no question about it. And I was very excited when I heard you were going to be on the docket, and of course, it lived up to it as I knew it would. Thank you very much, Jim. Appreciate the chance to catch up with you today, and thank you all, everybody, for tuning in to mini episode number 513 of the FDH Lounge.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.